Welcome to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran. We're going to discuss the top local news stories of the week, bringing you up to date on what's been happening here in your backyard. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for joining me, Patrick. Sarah Brown will join us as well from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Lots of stuff to get to. And let's start with the news at the top of the paper today. Representative Brian Mannell resigning not only from this campaign for state senate, but from politics in general.
Yeah, this was a little bit of a shocker last night at the Cape Cod Community Media Center during a debate hosted by the League of Women Voters. Mannell used his opening statement to make that announcement. He announced that he was stepping out of the race to replace State Senator Dan Wolf. That campaign was ongoing. It was Mannell and Julian Sear from Truro and Sheila Lyons, Barnesville County Commissioner from Wellfleet, on the Democratic side. And this was a debate between the three of them that was planned. But Mr. Mannell announced at the beginning that he was not only going to step out of that race, but was going to resign from politics. He's the sitting state representative for the 2nd Barnstable District. And I think it, you know, left the room a little confused. He, after his announcement, which was a written statement that he read out, and he cited concerns for his family and the dark side of politics. And he has been involved in some pretty contentious battles, not only with the Republicans through the GOP, the state's GOP, and some PACs that have been going after him in recent campaigns, but also with his own party. Him and Julian Sear had some disagreements in the last couple of weeks, where there was some information that came out about an arrest warrant that was later resolved. It was an arrest warrant for Mr. Mannell and his wife that was related to a landlord-tenant dispute, and again, that was resolved. But he looked at that and said it was dirty politics, and it turns out that Mr. Sear had a opposition research group that had uncovered that information and then leaked it to the media. So there was a lot of this back and forth that led up to this. Mr. Mannell had already kind of shocked people when he decided to run for the Senate seat instead of pursuing a re-election campaign for his current seat. But now it looks like he's going to be out of politics entirely after this year. And again, cited a number of issues, the chief among them seeming to be wanting to spend more time with his family and shield them from the kind of things that do happen during campaigns and politics.
So now we're left with Mr. Sear and Sheila Lyons for the primary in the Democratic side?
On the Democratic side, that's the primary right now. And they did go forward with the debate last night. And again, I think it was a little a bit of an adjustment, because Mr. Mannell got up and walked out to a round of applause from the audience. And then they went on with the debate. But I think, again, they were a little confused. On the Republican side, in that primary, there's the retired Air Force Brigadier General Anthony Scavi of Harwich and Barnstable Town Councilor James Crocker of Osterville. So whoever wins on the Democratic side obviously has to go up against one of those folks.
Okay. We heard about some changes in the Fisheries Commission being prompted by Governor Charlie Baker. What can you tell us, Patrick?
Yeah, this happened a couple of weeks ago, where the Baker administration basically changed 7 out of 9 of the sitting members of the state's Marine Fisheries Advisory Commission, replaced them. And this is a commission that basically, again, advises the Division of Marine Fisheries. They meet in monthly meetings, discuss, and then they vote on the Division of Marine Fisheries proposals. So for local fishermen here on the Cape, some of these decisions could have some impact. And when this happened, a lot of people were concerned about what that impact could be and what the motivation was. There were some people who our reporter spoke to who wondered whether it was retribution for the board not supporting a candidate that Baker's administration had put forward for the director of the Division of Marine Fisheries, and this was Douglas Crystal. The board had rejected that candidate and gone with another candidate instead. So it seemed that some people were worried that this was basically him saying, well, you don't like my candidate, I'm going to replace you folks. And the Baker administration did talk to us and said that that wasn't the case, and that decision has been made, and it's water under the bridge, and they'll live with the director as chosen. But they said that they decided that they needed some new blood on the division, on the commission. Mm-hmm. It is interesting that a lot of these folks have been there for a long time, and some of them have been there well past the kind of expiration date of their terms, and they just kind of have stayed on, and there hasn't been a reappointment process as would normally happen. So you know, there is probably some logic in looking at this and saying maybe it's time for some new faces. Again, our reporter Doug Frazier spoke to some folks locally, and they said this could be an opportunity to, again, get some new ideas, fresh insight, and move forward. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of concern because a lot of these people who were chosen to replace those current members on the commission are people with a lot of experience in commercial fishing and in the industry, and so people here on the Cape seemed comfortable with the idea that they would be represented well by this group.
Oh, that's good to know. Good reporting there. Let's talk about this Mashpee stun gun incident. Now, this is an incident that was recorded on video, showed up on the Boston News channels. What happened here?
Yeah, this was back on March 4th. There were some officers from Mashpee who went to a home on Cranberry Lane to issue an arrest warrant against Ryan Ridenour. He was wanted on a charge of assault and battery on a police officer out of Wrentham District Court. And they went to this home, and Mr. Ridenour's girlfriend, we're told by his attorney, did videotape the incident on presumably a phone. And it showed the officers with Ms. Ridenour sitting in a car. And they essentially, the result was they ended up using a taser or a stun gun on him. In the video, you see Mr. Ridenour and you hear him saying that he essentially isn't doing anything. He'll cooperate. His hands are shown. There is certainly an open question as to what happened before the videotape that we've seen so far. And there is an ongoing internal investigation that the chief of police there in Mashpee, Scott Carline, has undertaken. It's actually completed. But the results of that investigation aren't available. Carline says that he is waiting until the criminal case against Mr. Ridenour moves forward. And after that moves forward, he says, release the results of that investigation. He says his officers knew they were being videotaped, that presumably that's an indication that they believe their actions were warranted. Obviously, Mr. Ridenour feels differently. And this videotape came out after a judge had rejected a motion by Mr. Ridenour's attorney to essentially get a hold of that internal investigation surrounding this incident. So, there is a question as to the motivation of releasing the videotape. But if you view the videotape, and you can do that on our website, people can kind of make a decision for themselves within the context of what you see there. Again, there may have been something that came before what you see there, but we don't know that at this point.
Sure. Very important to note that. And of course, that, as you said, the video's on the website. Let's go to the phone where Sarah Brown is joining us. Sarah's with the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I understand that there's a new ferry that's going to be arriving here in Woods Hole and on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, a brand new ferry, which is pretty exciting, especially for those of us on the islands. So it's a big deal. And the Steamship Authority's brand new ferry, the Woods Hole, arrived in Massachusetts this week after traveling straight up the coast from Louisiana, where she was built. She's been at the Fairhaven dock since Monday morning and going through her final fitting out. And one of our reporters had a bow to stern tour of the ship on Tuesday and got to see everything from the engines to the wheelhouse. So it was pretty exciting. She's kind of a new type of vessel, a hybrid freight and passenger ferry. So she's 235 feet long and can carry up to 10 full-width tractor trailers or 55 passenger cars or a combination of both. So it's kind of pretty versatile. Mm-hmm. And she, one detail I like, it's very brand new, but she also has an antique steam whistle from the passenger ferry, the state of Pennsylvania. So there's something kind of new and old on the ferry. But next week is kind of the big week for the Woods Hole, and she's going to be debuting She'll be commissioned on Monday at the Woods Hole dock at noon, and there will be, I guess, a formal reading of the orders of commission and a lot of dignitaries, the raising of the colors. And then she takes her first trip to Vineyard Haven and is expected to arrive around 3. Well, she'll be open for an open house on the vineyard. People can come tour it, get their first look at the new ferry from 3 to 4:30 on the vineyard. And then she goes back to Woods Hole. And then on Tuesday, she goes to Nantucket for the first her inaugural Nantucket route. And she'll be open for tours there from 1 to 2:30 on Tuesday. And then on Friday, she starts service, and she'll be running between Oak Bluffs and Woods Hole for the summer.
And does this ferry replace an older ferry?
The plan was originally to replace the ferry Governor. That was the original plan, the freight ferry. I know that there's been talks recently that they might actually keep the Governor in commission and just have a little bit more versatility. The plan, I think, for Woods Hole is, after the summer is that she'll be working the Nantucket route. So it remains to be seen if the Governor will continue to be in service too. But it sounds like, last I heard, they might keep that going, so there's a little more versatility and another option.
Okay, very exciting for folks who ride the ferry, and there's quite a number of them.
There are.
That's true. Sarah Brown of the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
And Patrick Cassidy is with us from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. We're going to take a quick break. Patrick will stay with us, keep filling us in on the news of the week, and Tim Wood will join us as well from the Cape Cod Chronicle. And welcome back to the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, news director here at WCAI. Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times is joining us from the Cape Cod Times newsroom this morning. Patrick, let's talk about this South Yarmouth nursing home. We had spoken about this, I think, last week and about some concerns about an incident there, and now the state has stepped in with some fines.
Well, yes, and it's still to be determined exactly what those fines are. And even since our last story, we've learned some more information. The Windsor Skilled Nursing and Rehabilitation Center was initially placed in, and this kind of quotes, it's a state term, in jeopardy by the State Department of Public Health on May 27th. This was stemming from a March 1st incident in which a resident there, somebody who was staying there, went into, I believe, cardiac arrest. There was a medical condition, and then they subsequently died, and the state had concerns about how staff responded to that. So since then, we've learned that immediate jeopardy finding has been changed to a non-immediate jeopardy finding, and we're still doing some reporting on that, and we'll have more on that story shortly. But again, this was an incident, and the state took a look. They found some deficiencies in how the nursing home was handling certain things, and have required some corrective action. The spokesperson for the nursing home says that they're happy that things are moving along so quickly in terms of getting out of this in jeopardy finding. The important thing at one point, and still existing at this point, is that the nursing home can no longer accept additional basically residents or customers. And so for the time being, that's still in place. And they are moving forward with these kind of corrective actions, which are training. And this is the state obviously taking a look and reviewing how things are handled there. But as of right now, again, the immediate jeopardy finding versus the non-immediate jeopardy finding is essentially a state saying that they don't see an immediate threat to people, anybody who's staying there at this point. But they still do have these concerns and these deficiencies that need to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Tim Wood is joining us now from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Sean.
Tim, shark season is beginning. Research trips are starting up as well?
Research trips are actually going to start on Monday, yes. State shark biologist Greg Skomel and his team will be beginning the third year of their five-year shark population study Monday, going out from Chatham Harbor on a boat with spotter pilot Wayne Davis above, directing them to any great white sharks he may see along the coast. So far, there have been no sightings of white sharks reported yet this season. Last year, the first sighting wasn't until about June 22nd. Mm-hmm. But in years past, according to Cynthia Weigren of the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, the receiver buoys that they place along the Outer Cape and in many other areas now have picked up previously tagged sharks as early as Memorial Day weekend, and they won't know that until they get out there and check those receivers, which they'll start doing on Monday. So there's a chance they could actually have a first sighting next week. Even though ScoMo wasn't very optimistic about that, the water's been a little cool. We've had a cool spring, and that usually impacts the time the influx of great whites show up on our shores. What's clear is that once these sightings do happen, which they will, of course, shark enthusiasts on land will be able to find out about them almost immediately through a new smartphone app that the Conservancy is developing. It's called Sharktivity, and it's now in beta testing, but it's going to be available for free download for iPhones beginning on July 1st. Mm-hmm. Now, Cynthia Wygren says that this app will allow scientists to post the sightings right from the boat, and they can notify the public and beach managers when they see sharks close to swimming beaches or where people are surfing or whatever. And lifeguards along the beach will also have the ability to post sightings that are confirmed, and those will go out through through alerts and notifications. Beachgoers or other folks who see boaters who see sharks can also upload photos through this app, or you know, post notifications of where they've seen them. It has it'll record the GPS of where the photos are taken, and those will go right to shark researchers so they can determine, number one, confirm that it's a great white, and number two, decide if they need to put out a further alert on it. So it's another tool, they say, in both streamlining communications for beach management and also getting people involved in shark science.
Okay, another reason to look at our phones, I guess. I saw a photo of you on social media sitting in a time machine. Maybe you should explain that, Tim Wood.
Yeah, well, you're talking to Tim Wood from 2 weeks ago right now, of course. But it's Back to the Future week here in Chatham. And the classic 1985 film was shown here at the Orpheum Theater on Wednesday. And one of the things that people really flocked to was a reproduction of the DeLorean time machine that is featured in all three of those movies. It was parked out in front of the theater Wednesday. It was great. People were sitting in it, getting their photos taken. It was a lot of fun. Inside the theater, star Christopher Lloyd and co-writer and producer Bob Gale were there. They met with fans. They signed autographs. They answered questions for about an hour-long discussion after the film was shown. And all this week, they've participated in a couple of wine dinners and receptions sponsored by the Chatham Inn at 359 Main to raise money for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. Of course, that's founded by the film star Michael J. Fox, who suffers from the neurological disease. They've managed to raise tens of thousands of dollars this week through these events.
That's great.
Fans came from all over the Cape, off Cape, to see these folks and to sit in the DeLorean, which was really a lot of fun, really right down to the last detail. It's a perfect reproduction of the car.
Yeah, it's great. I saw the hoverboard next to it too. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, out doing the important work of uncovering the DeLorean time machine and all that.
Exactly.
Appreciate it, Tim. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks, Sean.
Patrick Cassidy is on the line, of course. Actually, he's from the our small little studio in the Cape Cod Times newsroom there. Patrick, tell us about Hyannis water advisory that's continuing.
Yes, this advisory went into effect, I think, a week or two ago, and it was based, and there's other communities that have been affected by this. It was based on a change in the EPA regulations for perfluorinated compounds of emerging concern. These are PFOs and PFOA, if anybody cares about the acronyms. But in any case, these particular compounds, the EPA decided that they would lower the threshold for what was safe for public consumption. And there was, I believe, one well in Hyannis that was affected by this. Officials in Barnstable and Hyannis shut that well down, but I think the concern was that there was some lingering water in the system that might have been coming from that well, and so they went ahead and provided, and actually as you drive into Hyannis on Yarmouth Road, you'll see off to the side at one of the water facilities, stacks of bottled water that residents from Hyannis can go and get for free. And that water is provided for as an abundance of caution for most people, but in particular, the warning for pregnant women, nursing mothers, and infants is one of the reasons that this EPA standard was lowered. There was some studies that came back that raised particular concerns about that population. So the advisory remains in effect in Hyannis. officials here in Hyannis say that they've taken a lot of steps to move forward so that they can reopen that well. One is they're going to install a carbon treatment system, as they have at other wells, to try and alleviate the problem. They've also established an interconnection with Yarmouth to bring water from that community into Hyannis. This was done last year as well, but this year it seems like this is kind of the impetus for it moving forward for the time being. And then they've resampled all water sources within the system. The results of those samples are expected back shortly, but the bottom line is, if you are somebody in that population that I mentioned earlier, pregnant women, nursing mothers, and infants, they do have bottled water that they're providing for you, and they're saying, you know, it's not even like you can boil the water and deal with this. You really should be drinking water from the bottles. If you're somebody who's, you know, a normally healthy person and not falls into one of those categories, they say they'll still provide bottled water for you if you like. They say it's not as much of a concern in the short term. Over the longer term, they would say that it would be a potential problem based on these studies if somebody were drinking this water that was contaminated like this over the longer term, no matter who they were. So a lot of concerns, obviously, in the community about this, and town officials say they're doing everything they can, and they hope that everything will return to a more normal status as far as people being able to drink the water going forward.
Okay, Patrick Cassidy, thank you. Joshua Balling is joining us on the line from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror Newsroom. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I understand you broke some news. John Kerry selling his house?
Apparently so. We actually didn't break it, unfortunately. It broke in the Boston Globe.
We broke it for me,
Josh. But we followed it up, got it confirmed. Yes, apparently the home on Hulbert Avenue, the waterfront home of John Kerry and his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, is quietly on the market for $25 million. Quite a bit of money out here on Nantucket, but actually only the fourth highest listing on the island right now, behind a $35 million property and a couple of $29 million properties. But realtors on the island yesterday confirmed that it is for sale. Some realtors have taken a tour of the property on the condition that they not take any photographs and not discuss the fact that it's for sale
that works
publicly, and then market it discreetly to some of their more well-heeled clients. It's a property that Secretary of State Kerry has come to quite frequently over the years during his candidacy for president, during his time as Secretary of State, and right through, you know, he's been here a couple of times over the last few months. He's got a boat that he docks on the island, and he and his wife both spend quite a bit of time here when they can in the summer. So it came as a surprise to quite a few people, be honest, myself included, since his time in public office certainly seems, or public service seems to be winding down a bit, that they might want to do this. But, you know, the property's owned by Teresa Hines Carey's family, and, you know, who knows what decisions get made at that level. But $25 million, and Secretary of State John Kerry's home on the water here on Nantucket, overlooking Nantucket Harbor, could be yours.
Well, maybe they're only downsizing.
It could be. You know, we've asked around a little bit, too, and it's not completely clear whether they intend to buy something else on the island or give up their island property altogether.
And Patrick Cassidy, I heard you there. What was that, Patrick?
I was just saying I won't need to ask Josh for that spot on the couch next to Fagawi. I'll just be able to go to my new house on the island.
Well, there you go.
Yes. The journalism salary rates are radically increasing. Yeah, Josh, tell us about this interesting story about genetically altered mice and the potential that those mice could somehow combat Lyme disease.
Apparently, a MIT professor, assistant professor, has come up with the idea of genetically altering laboratory-raised mice so that they carry antibodies or immunities to Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. And his idea is to breed tens of thousands of these mice, release them on the island, and hopefully over several generations create a strain of mice that is no longer susceptible to tick-borne diseases. The white-footed mouse, contrary to what a lot of people think when they hear about deer and other animals, is the largest reservoir of tick-borne diseases on Nantucket. And his feeling is that if you could wipe that carrier out, you could go a long way toward reducing the incidence of Lyme disease. Nantucket, if not the top, right there at the top in the number of instances of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases in the country. It causes lots of problems, lots of anguish for a lot of people out here. So it's something that the Islanders are looking at pretty carefully. Some tick experts, tick-borne disease experts like Nantucket Cottage Hospital's Dr. Tim Lepre, Tufts University's Sam Telford, expressing some cautious optimism about this. They say they're interested. They think, you know, if it works, it could be a great idea, but they're withholding judgment until they hear a little bit more. And it'll be quite some time, probably before this even gets off the ground, let alone before anything might happen. Probably cost about $10 million, according to professor and biochemist Kevin Esvelt, who's the professor that's proposing this, and at least a couple years away from even starting.
Fascinating science. Of course, those ticks are born without disease, and they usually are picking it up from the mice or squirrels.
They
or
are. A lot of people don't understand that, I think. And it's interesting that they think the ticks are the one that carry the disease, and that's not true at all. They get it from the mice. They get it from deer. That's the other big thing out here, is that Lepre and Telford both said that they still believe that controlling the deer population would go as far, if not further, in reducing or eliminating tick-borne diseases on the island than an experiment with genetically altered mice.
All right, Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Enquirer-Mirror. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Patrick Cassidy is with us as well from the Cape Cod Times, of course. But let's go quickly to Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. And got some news to tell us about regarding the CEO of Outer Cape Health.
Right. Outer Cape Health Services, which is huge out here. They have clinics in Provincetown, Wellfleet, and Harwich. Announced that Sally Dean will no longer be the chief executive officer. She's been the chief executive officer for 6.5 years, and it's kind of unclear why this occurred. We've been hearing rumors for about 6 months that she was on her way out. But earlier this week, Patricia Nadel, who is right now the chief operating officer, told Ed Miller of the Banner that Sally Dean decided not to continue in her position as CEO because the Outer Cape Health Services expansion plans, which would double the size of the organization, means that there would be a change in the job of CEO. The CEO would no longer be doing the day-to-day operations, but instead would focus on strategic and long-term planning and development. Apparently, Dean didn't want to do that.
So do we know if there's another role for her, or she's
apparently
just gone?
Apparently there's not. She asked to be on leave when they were sort of discussing what to do with her position, and it sounds like she's just out on Saturday. We don't really know why. She called the Banner but declined to comment on the record, so we just think she's out, and they're going to meanwhile look for another CEO, and Nadel's going to take her position until one is found.
And where does that expansion stand with the Outer Cape Health Services now? Do you know?
Well, the P-Town Clinic is amazing, because the P-Town Clinic right now has like a phlebotomist, an eye doctor, a dentist, mammograms, everything all in one place, and a pharmacy. Wellfleet, they need to do a complete overhaul of the place. They need to rebuild it. And there's issues regarding well water there and whether the Wellfleet water system will have to expand so that it can serve Outer Cape Health so that it can become bigger and continue. I'm not really sure about Harwich because that's sort of out of our area. I've never even seen the clinic in Harwich.
And may you never have to. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you very much for that news. Appreciate it, Ann.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Patrick Cassidy with us as well from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. Patrick, the Times was able to get some more information by requesting some documents about what happened when the Provincetown Police Chief Jeff Duran was kind of pushed out of his position after some controversy there. What did these documents tell us?
Yes, we had actually requested these documents going back a little bit as part of Sunshine Week, which is all about transparency in government. And this seems like a perfect candidate for why that's important. Chief Duran in Provincetown left the job, selectman, after some contention agreed to pay him $512,000 that was in 2015. They agreed to that. That was after an arbitrator found that he shouldn't have been fired for some things that he did, but he should have been suspended for a year instead. And this was something he had done based on the election, where he had pushed officers to vote for a certain candidate, and that violated local, state, and federal laws. In any case, during that whole back and forth and his firing and eventual basically winning that money in that arbitration, there was a lot of negotiations. And it appears that the town could have settled earlier with him for about $163,000 less than that amount. He had offered to leave for $350,000 at one point. I think either the town had countered or had come to him initially with an offer of $50,000. He obviously didn't think that was enough, but he had offered $350,000. I think the town council at that point had advised selectmen to negotiate before they went into this arbitration process, but they went forward with arbitration and they ended up paying that additional money. So again, it's an instance where this was, you know, buried within these executive session minutes, which are minutes that for various exemptions, selectmen and other boards can hold away from the public and hold these meetings where the public is not privy as to what happens within those meetings to a certain point, and it's based on a number of different exemptions. Now, we did ask for a lot of these records between a certain period of time. I think it was over 12 months or something like that. And we did get a lot of them. A lot of them that we got were either blacked out still. They were redacted. The information was removed. And in one case, the meeting in which it was actually decided that he would be fired, we didn't get those minutes at all. And the town council now cited basically a unwarranted invasion of privacy and cited one of these exemptions that allows witnesses to be protected when they're testifying in an instance like that, and also attorney-client privilege, which seems to could cover anything where the attorney is sitting in the room talking to selectmen. Basically, it's a privilege between the selectmen and their attorney. So there are still a lot of things within these minutes that we do not know. But we did find out, again, by requesting these minutes and getting a hold of them, that the selectmen might have been able to get out of this cheaper and earlier than they actually did. So that at least is something that the public can know about how these decisions are made.
Okay, well, thank you for going after those documents. Let's go to the phone with Jim DeRuta is joining us from the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Jim, let's start with the bobcat kittens.
Yeah, a couple bobcat kittens came to the New Bedford Buttonwood Park Zoo this week. They're 10 weeks old. They were orphaned in Southern California and cared for a little while at the San Diego Zoo until they were ready to move here. Zookeepers in New Bedford do have expertise and familiarity with large wild cats. They have a Canada lynx and a cougar there.
Hmm.
The bobcat, I wonder if you knew, is the most abundant wild cat in the United States. And these two little cats here were introduced to the zoo community and members yesterday. And over the next 2 weeks, the public will get a chance to see them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. When I saw your note about bobcat kittens, I was thinking that they were roaming the Cape or the South Coast, but they're actually in the zoo. So.
No, but they do have pretty wide range.
Right. Let's talk about town meetings in your area of the woods there near the New Bedford area.
Yeah, three towns had meetings this week, Dartmouth, Freetown, and Lakeville. Freetown and Lakeville are kind of tied together by their regional school system, so they were both able to successfully appropriate about $500,000 to upgrade and maintain and repair the HVAC system in the middle school swimming pool, which is used year-round for lessons and life-saving courses, plus all the educational uses of it, too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, Lakeville also decided to fund $400,000 to start planning a new police station, kind of in contrast with Dartmouth, where not only did they fail with a police station question at the polls about a month ago, they decided that they're not even going to bother with trying to start again, and they voted to just table police station issues and move them on ahead. Also, in Dartmouth, they voted not to accept $1 million from the state to build a maritime center in South Dartmouth, which some of the Cape listeners may even be familiar with. Peyton Arum in South Dartmouth is a real big sailing center. But town people had no appetite for the police station a month ago, no appetite for the Maritime Center.
People are feeling pretty stretched, I think.
In some towns, they are.
Yeah. Jim DeRuda, the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Patrick Asti is here from the Cape Cod Times, of course. Several more stories to talk about, important stories from that paper, as well as Nelson Siegelman will join us when we return from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back to the News Roundup here on The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. Patrick Cassidy is with us from the Cape Cod Times. Also with us now is Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Nelson, the story just keeps coming back about the Aquinas efforts to bring gambling to the island. And what's the latest?
Well, this is a pretty interesting development. The U.S. Department of Justice stepped into this long-running legal battle. They filed basically with a friend of the court brief. It doesn't make them a party to the suit, but it says that they're interested in it and they're siding with the Wampanoag tribe of Gay Head in their efforts to jump into the sort of casino scrum, if you will. But really what this is all about is it's called the Settlement Act, which made the tribe, the tribe signed it in order to settle a long-running land dispute, and it basically said they would abide by the local state laws, zoning requirements in effect at that time. And the feds are saying that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act trumped the Settlement Act and that it basically repeals it. So if, in fact, the tribe's successful in its appeal, It would really change the entire legal landscape on Martha's Vineyard, or at least the foundation of the legal foundation of the relationship, and that would be pretty significant.
Now, that's the same argument that the tribe has been making, which has been rejected by federal judges. You know, that's why we're at an appeals process now, right?
Correct. And the next step would be the Supreme Court. And, you know, these legal battles are long, they're expensive, and this one's been going along. And for listeners who aren't aware of it, there's a community center that's been unbuilt up on the tribal lands. And for a while, they said they wanted to turn the community center into a Class 2 gaming facility. And now they're completing the community center, but the tribe did last year buy some adjoining acreage, which I suppose could be a place that they could erect a different building. But I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind here is that although the tribal lands are located up in Aquinas, the smallest town on Martha's Vineyard, a lot of the tribal membership lives in southeastern Massachusetts, and they're the ones who have the voting power. They're the ones that would be calling the shots. So that's one of the things that I think people on the vineyard find a little bit concerning. It's one, you know, generally speaking, when we've talked to the residents of Aquinas, the tribal members in Aquinas, they're against the notion or the idea of having even a small casino in Aquinas. They know it would significantly change the nature of their town. But the people who live in southeastern Mass are thinking that it would be an economic boost, so they're not that concerned about it.
Good point. Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson.
You're welcome.
Okay. Patrick Cassidy is with us from the Cape Cod Times newsroom. Patrick, tell us about the suspension of alcohol service for the Cape Verdean Club.
Yes, this is something that goes back to an April 10th shooting outside of the club, which is located on Sandwich Road in Falmouth. The shooting has not been solved. One person, I believe, was struck in the knee with a bullet. And what had happened previous to that, according to what the police say, is that somebody inside the club had shown a gun, and then, again, this shooting had taken place outside of the club. And what officials in town have an issue with is that the police weren't immediately called, and certainly the police chief has an issue with that as well, when the gun was shown. The club, officials, club vice president Wesley Lette, said that he was only told about the gun as the club was being shut down after an argument that had taken place there. And basically, things were unfolding rapidly, and so they had shut the club down, and they didn't really have time at that point to have called the police. By the time the police arrived, there was only one or two people there, I think a security guard and somebody else, and the person who had been shot had already was already at the hospital. They had received the police received a call from the hospital about the gunshot victim. So that raised a lot of concerns for officials, and they did vote 4-0 on Monday night to limit the club's event attendance to members and guests only, and to prohibit them from serving alcohol to anyone until a June 27th hearing on alleged violations of the liquor license. And these go beyond just the way that the shooting was handled. There were other violations that the police chief said that he found during his investigation, including the club not having a valid manager listed on its license, and them serving alcohol to people who weren't members and guests, which are the limits of the club's liquor license. So again, there are concerns. The club says they're trying to address these concerns, and then they feel like they are maybe unfairly addressed here. So we'll see what happens during that next hearing.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, violence of any sort raises a lot of concerns with town officials.
Well, obviously, if this was a regular restaurant or bar, even a suspension of that duration could put him under. Any idea about how big or how popular this club is?
Well, there's a large Cape Verdean population in Falmouth. There's a large Cape Verdean population or of Cape Verdean descent on the Cape. I think this club's, from my understanding, attendance of events there kind of waxes and wanes over time. And so, you know, I think they have events and a lot of people come out, but it's not as if you go there and it's always crowded or the parking lot is always full. It is a club, and so it's a limited to a certain group of people,
right,
in many respects. So again, somewhat different from a public restaurant, but those concerns, as you said, would certainly put a public restaurant under. The club says, I think they've said in the past, that the alcohol that they sell there is a large part of their revenue. So it really could be a problem for them if that is suspended for any period of time.
Okay, some important discussions this week about our oldest residents and how they get around, which can be a real challenge, as well as some other issues as our region continues to age. What happened here, particularly when it comes to transportation?
Well, the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority decided that they were going to implement a plan they're calling Plan for Senior Boom. And they say this was prompted by actually an editorial in our paper from April, which talked about the efforts that are needed to meet the future needs of the Cape's aging population. And we've talked about this. We've written about this. You've talked about it on the air quite a bit. The Cape is an older population, is aging rapidly. So one of the things that's most important for that population is getting around and the hurdles that are involved in getting from point A to point B. If you're not driving anymore, if you shouldn't be driving anymore for whatever reason. So the RTA says that they're going to start to try and work more collaboratively with senior centers, and they're going to try and basically provide services in a way where people who are older and who may not be able to drive are able to use the services of the RTA better. One of the things that came up during reporting by Marianne Bragg on this is that not all the senior centers, not a large portion of them, don't have stops that are on fixed routes that are served by these buses. So to get from the senior center to a bus, you either have to do one of the kind of on-call services that the RTA offers, or in some other way get to a bus stop. So they're looking at how to address that, and they're also looking to provide information to senior centers and to the people who go there as to how they might use the system a little better. So I think there's a lot to talk about here.
Yeah.
Transportation in a rural area like Cape Cod is always difficult for anybody, but certainly for a population who may not be able to drive or who may have difficulty driving as they get older, it could be even more difficult.
Right. The town of Eastham there's an ongoing effort there to really create some more affordable housing. There's a site that has been identified now. The Cape Cod Times is reporting that a developer has been chosen for this 10-acre site.
Yes, and there were two who were in contention for developing this site. The town has been trying to develop this site for a long time. It's off Brackett Road in Eastham. I think for 15 years they've been trying to get somebody there to get some affordable housing there. But the problem has generally been the lack of a water system. And Eastham has recently moved forward with a new municipal water system, which would allow for an increased density in that area. And that's what developers really look for, is the ability to have more people. So in any case, Eastham officials have chosen a Philadelphia-based company. This is Penrose, I believe, Penrose Properties, to move forward with a plan. And they have a plan for 65 units of affordable housing on this piece of property. And they chose them for a number of reasons. They said their design was better than the alternative. They were going to have on-site management. They were going to have more units. They were going to be basically energy efficient and meet LEED standards. And they had a more aggressive construction schedule, saying that they could have the development ready by December of 2018, which is pretty quick. So the hope is out there that they'll be able to move forward with this. There's another affordable housing project that was actually proposed by the other developer who was working on a proposal for this property as well. So Eastham is trying to figure out a way to have affordable housing with all the problems that come with selecting a site, whether it's neighbors who are concerned or, again, infrastructure, as was the case here. They, like all the other Cape towns, are really struggling with that.
Mm. And let's talk about some of our younger residents. The Boy Scouts are preparing for a more than $1 million expansion in Yarmouthport.
Yeah, this is at Camp Greeno in Yarmouthport, and this, the Cape Cod and Islands Council Boy Scouts of America has announced a campaign to raise $1.2 million for a welcome and education center there. Their goal is to have that money in hand by October 1st and get a shovel in the ground and start working before the snow flies, as reporter Christine Legere wrote about it.
Yeah.
The facility there currently is only for two seasons. It was built in 1948. So you can imagine the condition over the years that that facility is in. It was built originally, again, for Boy Scouts who were staying there, you know, during those two seasons. Now the camp's limited to day use, but they are hoping that the new center, which would be, I believe, 4,700 square feet, would be open year-round. And it would also be a place where they would have a STEM education and training wing. This is science, technology, math and engineering.
Yep.
Not in that order. And so, like all the schools, they're looking at the possibility of having that. But they also hope it's a place where other organizations may come and use it. It's going to be a large space, and we have some renderings on our website and with the story today showing it, a large space that somebody may be able to use for other purposes. They say, two large donations in hand from foundations, but they're obviously looking for more. I think hopefully one of the organizers said, well, a $500,000 donation would be nice. Wouldn't it always be nice if somebody came forward with something like that? But they're hoping that people will see this as a worthy cause and start giving.
Now, Patrick, we actually have a couple minutes left here. Yep. Real quick, I know that we didn't mention that we were going to talk about this story, but there is someone on the Cape who has come into a bit of money, and that also benefits the business that sold this lottery ticket, one of the new lottery tickets. The winner is Wright and Sandwich, right?
Yes, she did win, and she did win $15 million. And this was a very popular story when we put it up online. And I think it's one of those where people see something like that and they say, oh, why couldn't that be me? But in any case, the winner was from East Sandwich, and she claimed her ticket the other day. The store in this case, I think, was a store in Mashpee, and she was on the way to the gym, and she went to the Mashpee Country Store, and this is Hillary Almer is her name. Not that she really wants it probably out there at this point. I'm sure all sorts of people are calling her.
Right.
But she went on the way to the gym. She bought this $30 lottery ticket, and she walked away with $15 million or some portion thereof after taxes, I'm sure. The store actually will receive a $50,000 retailer bonus, and I think when our reporter called, they didn't know about that yet, so I'm sure that was we're not always somebody who you want to have calling you, but in this case it was probably a welcome call at that point. But again, people were really looking at this story online and really interested. I think it goes to that idea of, hey, why couldn't that be me? What would I do with $15 million? I don't know if you already know in your head, Sean, what you would do.
Well, I know that I don't think I would ever take $30 out of my wallet and for a ticket like that, but
that's
why I never win.
Yeah, and I probably won't be seeing you at the new casino at this point. That's me too. Yeah. $30 seems like a lot to spend on anything for me, but on a chance to win that's unlikely to be come to fruition, it's really tough. But she did win, certainly it does happen. And we've had a few local winners recently of $1 million, but she got the big prize recently.
Yeah, I'm happy for her and for the business. Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Sarah Brown also joined us from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and we also heard from Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. These local journalists are out doing important First Amendment work. We appreciate it, and thank you for listening.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.